Thanks for having me. So I'm a solo practice urologist in Houston. I did my training at SUNY Downstate in New York and then a fellowship in robotic surgery in Urology San Antonio. And I practice broad general urology with an emphasis in minimally invasive surgery, but see quite a bit of general urology as well, overactive bladder, et cetera.
And when you're seeing those folks come in, all age groups, but especially the elderly, I mean, they're not just coming with OAB. They've got all these other comorbidities. Kind of what are you seeing most commonly in your area? And how do you manage that, or how does that impact your management?
Yeah, I mean, well, a lot of these, especially the elderly patients, there's a lot of polypharmacy. A lot of them are on numerous medications. They interact, can affect their cognitive function, et cetera. So there's a lot of care taken to make sure that the medications we give aren't going to interact with some of the medications already on and predispose them to further complications such as falls and et cetera that can come with cognitive decline.
Are you having to deal with a lot of like metabolic syndrome, obesity, depression? Kind of how do you navigate all that? Or do you working with your primary care docs on that?
Sure. I think as I think a lot of urologists, we end up becoming the primary care doctor for some of these patients, A, because some of them don't want to go to anyone else, or B, because they just trust us for because they've been with us for so many years. So as a result, I find that I have ended up taking care of a lot more of those conditions, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. Yeah, we see quite a bit of metabolic syndrome patients. I see, for example, a lot of patients with sleep apnea. And I've made it a habit to, when I see polycythemia to think about that. When I have these patients with nocturia, I'm also making a clear distinction between nocturnal polyuria and basically lack of or ADH related nocturia. So those are trees, I guess, decision trees and algorithms that I didn't really get so far into during residency, but later during practice, it's kind of evolved as an important part of seeing my patients.
And as we work with so many guys and men and women with OAB, for example, what physiological changes are you seeing as they age and as they're coming back 5 years, 10 years? What are you seeing in your clinic?
It's an interesting point. We're seeing quite a bit, especially in the male population. I'm seeing a lot of patients with decompensated bladders, trabeculated bladders, loss of compliance, sometimes just irritable bladders. And so those patients with untreated BPH or very late treated BPH oftentimes have some of these OAB symptoms that have more recently become our domain. I know, or I remember when I was a resident, we almost never would give, back then it was anticholinergics, but now, really, we weren't really treating OAB with these type of patients because we were always af afraid of putting them in retention. However, now we see a lot more of these patients who have, not had TURPs and have been managed medically or not at all. And some of them have had, chronically overactive bladders, probably from decompensation from bladder obstruction for too long. And then on the female side, we see a lot of chronic changes as well. I see a lot of patients who, have increased UTIs or have atrophic vaginitis, haven't had any hormone replacement therapy of their vaginal wall, et cetera, and have a confusing picture of, irritate avoiding symptoms.
Have you now seen, because we've talked about, you mentioned anticholinergics in the past, right? That was kind of the go-to back in the day. But something that I've noticed now with the pandemic is the emergence of these newer data building upon mirabegron, the beta-3 agonist. And have you kind of looked at that, and how are you incorporating all that latest data on vibegron? I think that's those two are the main ones for beta-3 agonists. And kind of how are you now evolving your practice from anticholinergics, beta-3, a combination of both? Like, how are you managing that all?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I use both still, but I use a lot more beta 3 than anticholinergics, especially in the elderly population. The issues with cognitive decline and with confusion, you know, blood-brain barrier issues with the older anticholinergics really make them less of a go-to therapy. I think you know, obviously behavioral modification first, but when I'm choosing medication, my go-to really has become the beta 3s like vibegron. It's the side effect profile I think is favorable, the efficacy as well, and in the event that they don't get enough relief from the beta 3 alone, then I'll at times add an anticholinergic as well. Less so in the elderly population, but it really depends on their mentation and their cognitive function.
And I think if we can dive a little deeper, because I think you brought up the safety and the efficacy data, I think there was that Empower trial during the pandemic. Kind of what were your thoughts on that? What kind of were highlights or takeaways for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's real interesting if you look at the subpopulation in that trial at the greater than 65 and greater than 75 age groups, you find that they're roughly equivalent to the rest of the population, and you see the side effect profile quite favorable, especially when compared to anticholinergics. You know, that trial had three arms. It had the beta 3 arm, it had an anticholinergic arm, which was tolteridine, and it had a placebo arm. And if you look at that, the hypertension profile in particular was the same as placebo in the 60 greater than 65 and greater than 75 arm. So a lot of the same, a lot of the side effect profile that we used to be worried about with the mirbegron, the predecessor beta 3, weren't there on the second generation beta 3, the vibegron study on the Empower trial. So I think there's a lot of exciting safety data in that regard.
And did you feel, how do you like the fact that it's single dosing now? Like, you know, does that help or for your practice at all?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. You know, the single dosing simplifies life a little bit. Even before when in the press, you know, in the mid-background, that dual dosing, I really settled, you know, mostly on one dose. In that case, mostly the lower dose because it seemed to have much the same efficacy, and the side effect profile became a little bit prohibitive for me. And with the higher dosing, with the vibegron, you know, the side effect profile is favorable. There's only one dose. It's just easier, you know, for the patients.
And with the vibegron, when are you seeing the onset of benefit for you in your practice, or even in that study, kind of like, how does your experience compare to what's been published there?
Yeah, my experience is I see benefits, you know, early on, even a week after, even before, but definitely a week after, most definitely 2 weeks after. So I usually see these patients about a couple of weeks after. And by then, you know, it's pretty impressive with, you know, if they're going to have improvement, they've already seen it. And they're surprised, honestly, about how quickly they're seeing it. So I think we would see the same with the anticholinergics, meaning the onset was also good in terms of quick onset of action. But, you know, I think the key, though, is to explain to patients a lot of times the one of the biggest problems in this entire treatment class has been the tolerability and the length of time that the patients take it. So what I'm impressed by is the side effect profile with vibegron, which allows these patients to stay on it long term. Since, as I explained to them, you know, this isn't a cold. We're not going to cure you of this. We're treating symptoms. The discontinuation rates were so high with the anticholinergics that it's, you know, it's really an amazing change to be able to have patients that actually can stay on these medications long term, and then consequently get the benefits long term.
Would you say in your practice, like, they're 50% improved? You look at frequency or accidents from urge incontinence, 75%, like in your experience, or how does it compare to the Empower trial?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Empower trial, those are the endpoints. The primary endpoints were the urge incontinence episodes and the number of micturitions. And yeah, I see similar to the Empower trial. I see about a about a 50% improvement in the decrease in micturitions. And the Empower trial had about a 75% improvement in the incontinence rates. And I'm seeing that in my patients. I think it's pretty much in line with what the trial showed.
And switching gears a little bit, because as we focus on the specific population of the elderly, and you kind of brought up nicely that those studies have even looked at the specific age groups of over 65 and over 75, those folks are coming in, and there's a fair percentage that might be in long-term facilities. And kind of your thoughts on how do we better manage OAB in those locations, because that's where folks are living. And kind of your thoughts on how do we improve patient outcomes there? How do we make it more livable? Obviously, we talked about medications, but lifestyle, et cetera. Kind of where do you stand with that, and what do you suggest often to your patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. I think a lot of it has to do with their lifestyle in those places. For example, well, I would divide it into first section would be education. Educating their caregivers really on how to take care of these patients. The worst thing is to have someone in wet diapers, and having urine dermatitis and all the complications that occur from not having their diapers, changed. The problem with diapers oftentimes is just a way to put a band-aid over. You don't look at it, and so it's a lot of education in terms of teaching folks that a diaper doesn't mean we don't look. It means we look probably more often now because you want to make sure that the diaper is dry. You want to make sure that they're getting frequent changes, that they're we also want to make sure that they're not using alcohol wipes, that they're using something that's soft, just a damp towel with water is better than using caustic chemicals or fragrances. It's amazing what goes on in some of these homes that in the attempt to be sterile or cleaner, they're just creating more complications in the skin and skin breakdown, et cetera. So the other thing is I see a lot of these patients that have a lot of mobility issues. And so it's really important to bring commodes to the bed side, try to have lights that are motion detected turn on, try to make sure that they have slippers that are non-slip, or have floors that are non-slippery. Just basic things that have a lot of grab bars or handrails. Some facilities tend to have more of those handrails, but there are some more, even more pointed things that you can do, such as raising the toilets a little higher. Some of these patients have a hard time, sitting down without falling. And if you raise the toilets a little higher, it makes it easier for them to go to the restroom. So there's just a whole host of things you can do from a, I guess, lifestyle mobility issues to help patients get to the bathroom better.
Who they are, the depression, isolation, mood. I mean, do you see that impact as with time goes on if we leave that OAB untreated?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who suffer in silence. And then there's some that are extremely anxious about their symptoms. We see both. I mean, part of it, I think, of our job is to help tease out those patients that are suffering in silence, but you can see are depressed, and the answer depression scale scores are alarming. And when you dig beneath the surface, a lot of them are having incontinence and urge incontinence specifically, and are, like I said, suffering in silence. And then you also have the other side, which are women who are depressed and anxious and socially isolating themselves because they're afraid to go out in public, because they're afraid of being seen wet, always going to the restroom, et cetera. So they really self-isolate.
What are the long-term implications? So maybe let's take a subgroup. Let's look at men, right, with BPH OAB. How are you approaching that or educating them about the long-term consequences if we don't really take care of this?
That's a good question. I mean, I always start, I tell them, I think we should wear pins that say stop bladder abuse. You know, I think that's what's happening.
They have a hashtag, right? Stop bladder abuse.
It's true, because I think a lot of these patients are abusing their bladder. You know, one of the things that I've always had an issue with was the AUA symptom score. You know, the last question is quality of life. Do you have any change in your quality of life? And we're always taught as residents, if there's no complaint, if it's not a high change in quality of life, then you don't treat. But we don't do that with someone who has high cholesterol or high, you know, we don't wait, you know. So some of these patients are very stoic, especially male patients. And so those patients, I think it's incumbent upon us to look at their voiding symptoms and help them make decisions, you know. So when I see a patient that gets up five times a night, but he's like, yeah, I don't have a problem. It's just, you know, normal. It's part of getting older. It's incumbent upon them to explain the more often they get up at night, the more difficulties they're going to have. More often they get up at night, the more chance of a fall or a fracture, the more morbidities that can be associated with it. And so trying to explain the benefits of this, as well as helping them identify the problem, which they have yet to identify because they're so used to its gradual onset, I think is important. So one of the important things that I mentioned is the longer that they have a high pressure system, the greater chance that they're going to change irreversibly their bladder. And they will, even if we do fix their bladder outlet obstruction, now they'll have a highly irritable bladder. So the sooner we can treat that and create a low pressure system in their bladder, the better chance of them having a stable bladder thereafter. And we know that there's changes as you get older. Sometimes the afferent nerves, you know, naturally aren't as competent as they were when they were younger. But we know that when you have that bladder outlet obstruction, you get remodeling of the muscles and the fiber, and you get a lot of bladder nerve instability, and those afferent fibers don't work as well as they used to, et cetera. And now you're getting a lot of misfires, and you get a lot of overactive bladder symptoms that can be avoided. So again, stop bladder abuse, like protect your bladder, keep your systems low, your pressures low, and protect your bladders and your kidney.
I love that concept, stop bladder abuse. I think for the listeners, right? That's something just to really remember and to highlight that with our patients, especially the male patients, that BPH is actually really about bladder health. There are only two major organs you can't transplant, the brain and the bladder. So we better take care of it. You only have one.
Right. That's what I tell them. I can Roto-Rooter your prostate all day from here till whenever you want. I can't give you another bladder. So if you don't take care of the one you have, we're going to be dealing with it for the rest of your life. And so I agree with you 100%.
I think something that needs to evolve for men's health, just as we look at this subgroup, which is, I kind of call it IFS, I'm fine syndrome.
Yes.
Right. You kind of brought it up there with the quality of life score, which is they're actually not fine. They're fearful. They're fearful if they tell you they're not fine, you're going to start doing stuff to them. Right. And every day as men, we put on that armor of masculinity and education, like you brought up, highlighting, hey, hashtag stop bladder abuse. You only got one, right? We need to encourage men for the right reasons to take off that armor and engage with you. Like, I mean, how do you do? I'm obviously, it's very obvious you're super compassionate and you've got that mentality of let's be bladder centric. And like, how do you engage guys in the room, for example, to talk about their OAB and their BPH? How do you start that conversation?
Well, I mean, you know, I have my father's a physician, and so I've inherited a lot of his colleagues as my patients. And these are physicians that come to me and they tell me they have no problem, Pete. And then when you do a Uroflow on them and you look at their AUA symptom score, you're like, you know, I know you don't think you have a problem, but but I'm seeing a lot of things here. So part of it is explaining to them the pathophysiology of this, that it's a slow, insidious onset. So there's a combination of patients who don't want anything done to them. There's also a subset that truly believe there's nothing wrong. It's just part of getting older, and that's normal. And so, you know, yeah, it's more common as you get older. We know this with OAB. We know that men catch up to women, especially in older ages. You know, we traditionally think of OAB as a female condition. But we know once you reach the 60, 70, 80 age group, men catch up to women and recognize OAB. And a lot of that, I think, is due to untreated BPH. And, you know, some of it's due to decomposition in neural pathways, et cetera, but some of it is due to decomposition of the bladder. So I think it's really education. It's really explaining to them. And I use that analogy that I use with other things that we pick up on. You know, just because you don't know, you know, just because you feel fine doesn't mean that your PSA of 30 should be ignored, right? So it's not all about how you feel. There are things that we can pick up on as physicians, and it's our job to pick up on it, and to ignore it just because the patient says he feels fine, I think is doing him a disservice. So it really, I think it's just a matter, most patients get that. Once you explain to them that, you know, not being able to watch a movie because you got to go to the bathroom, it's not normal. And just because you're 70s doesn't mean that that's the way you need to live.
Something that you brought up earlier is just cultural differences. And I know you've published on this subject. Here in New Mexico, men from northern New Mexico who are having urgent continence, they have a word for that. They call them el viejo meow. This is the guy sitting on who leaks on us. He pees on himself. That's just him. It's acceptable. That's just the way it is with aging. But we've got, our generation really needs to start changing that paradigm. Something that we all worry about is those falls, right, of the elderly. And a lot of those things you've brought up are helpful. Are there any additional interventions that can be implemented, you think, to kind of mitigate the risk of OAB-associated falls in the elderly?
Yeah, I mean, one of the hardest things that I sometimes have to deal with is a patient who doesn't want to use a walker or canes, and convincing them to have that. It's not a sign that they're becoming disabled, but it's a sign that they are really in control more of their own destiny. And really with this population, it's important to let them know that they are in control of their own lives, to try to be able to ambulate as best they can. But it's important also to have them understand that how morbid a fall can be. And so when explaining those things, you know, it's some of my biggest victories has been convincing patients to use a walker, you know, where they don't want to, the family wants them to, but they don't want to. No, and you don't want to wait till they have that fall, till they're convinced. So as the urologist and slash kind of primary care doctor, that sometimes it's important to help them understand how important safe mobility is.
Are you seeing, at least in my neck of the woods, we're seeing this rise of folks with chronic UTIs, right? I mean, that's also as with incontinence and things aren't clean down below. I mean, how are you strategizing for that in this kind of subgroup of those with OAB and incontinence and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, so patients that have asymptomatic UTIs that are, you know, cognitively intact, that can complain, et cetera, I'm not, you know, going overboard. I'm making sure that they don't have kidney stones or other reasons for chronic UTIs. But I'll offer them topical estrogens if they're a female and they have atrophic vaginitis. If they're having symptomatic UTIs, then we'll usually do prophylactic suppressive doses like 50 milligrams of nitrofurantoin or one tablet of single strength Bactrim, and that'll usually keep them out of trouble. So it really depends on whether they're having symptomatic UTIs or whether they're colonized with asymptomatic UTIs that aren't really affecting them. So I guess that's the answer I would give you.
And so many people are on cranberry and, you know, just working together as a team there to try and motivate patients and explain the ramifications of not getting things treated, right? And maybe paint a picture of kind of what does the shared decision making look like, that process. You're in there, probably a daughter or a son or some family members in there with you and the patient, but how do you kind of discuss all the elements, the physical, the mental, the social, that can be really important issues to enhance the quality of life of, as you said, right, the silent sufferers? I mean, how do you approach that? Because it can be challenging.
Yeah, I mean, so it's important for it to be as multidisciplinary as possible. If you have a geriatrician, try to get on the same page. One of the reasons that I like the Vibegron medication is the lack of CYP2D6 activity. So those patients that are on things like tramadol, et cetera, are not going to have difficulty taking that medication. So one of the things is the polypharmacy. So with the geriatrician, trying to understand what medications they're on and that we're going to add this medication and making sure that we both understand what it can be taken with and what it can't be taken with. As far as the family, engaging the family to be involved as much as possible, especially in terms of checking to see that there's no skin breakdown, if they have, if they're more bed bound, making sure that they are encouraged to mobilize, make sure that they don't have bed sores, all those things that is very important. So the more you can communicate with the caregivers, whether it be, you know, professional caregivers or family caregivers, dramatically improves the quality of life of the patient. I agree. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it starts with education in our offices, and it continues with us educating caregivers that they might have at home or institutions or long-term care facilities. Educating that subset of caregivers is also very important. So there's just a tremendous need for education.
A little segue from our previous series episode, we were talking about primary care. And I confess, I'm guilty. I don't call the primary care docs to kind of give an update or educate. How are you doing that? Or, I mean, do we have time? I said, we're all so busy, but I think we need to start that dialogue. Kind of, do you have any tips or tricks for facilitating that communication about OAB management, when they need to refer to you? Kind of, where have you kind of landed on all that?
I mean, with my EMR, we sent them a note so they know what we're doing. But back in the day, I used to give a lot of talks at the Hispanic Medical Association meetings and a lot of primary care venues, that especially because I was just starting my practice and I wanted to meet primary care physicians. And as a result, I've developed a lot of rapport with some of them where they have my email or they have my cell phone, and they'll just, call me or text me and ask me questions. And so I encourage that as much as possible. I think it really builds a good relationship because I think that the bulk of this needs to be in the primary care space, meaning we don't see but a fraction of these patients that are suffering from overactive bladder. So it's incumbent upon us, there's not enough urologists. We're all saturated with patients. So I think it's really incumbent upon us to help primary care doctors understand how to differentiate between bladder outlet obstruction and OAB, and which medications are safe and which population groups. And I think there's a dearth of education in this area. This is why, I agreed to do this talk, and that's why I think there's a lot more that we could be doing in terms of trying to understand and explain what is really extremely prevalent condition.
I mean, if you had a magic wand, like you could wave it and change the medical landscape or the surgical landscape, and we haven't gotten there, but if OAB, what would you do? Like, what would you want?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, if I could do anything, I would love to have, some better apps or some better ways to have patients relay what's going on in their life to me objectively. So, whether And I always said for BPH, I thought it'd always be cool if, urinals and stadiums would just, send alarms. Like, once the flow rate was really poor, it would spit out a list of urologists in your zip code that you should visit one of them, And I think the same thing should happen if you go to, if you're going to Walgreens and you're buying Depends all the time, then it should spit out a list of urologists that you need to see. I mean, there's a lot of people that I think put Band-Aids on problems and they don't try to address the underlying problem because they either think it's not addressable or they think they're too old to address it. And I think it's unfortunate. So, I just before this talking to you, I had a patient who was convinced that he was too old for anesthesia because he was in his 60s. There's a lot of preconceptions and misinformation out there. And so a lot of people think they don't qualify for things or they're too old for things. They don't think that something is fixable. And I think overactive bladder fits a lot of those. Whether it be informing patients about PTNS or TENS or whether it's informing them about Botox injections or whether it's informing them about, there's a whole host of ways we can treat these things. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention probably one of the most important things is time voiding. A lot of patients, either drink an insane amount of fluids and or wait to pee until they're exploding. And just simply educating them on that does a world of difference. So there's just so many different ways that we can help these patients. I think there should be non-branded education seminars for primary care doctors on urology, because I think it kind of falls by the wayside. They think of this, the whole GU symptomatology is kind of just a nuisance, and then if it gets bad enough, they refer to urologists. But I think some of it is so easy to treat and so easy to make a difference that with a little bit of education, a lot of them wouldn't feel like it's such a burden to screen for it and to treat it.
I love your idea. Like in the supermarket or the convenience store, like if they go to purchase liners or di adult diapers, something pops up and go, "Hey, how many times are you buying this? I think you really should listen to this 30-second video, and go see a urologist." And then like they push a button, they can find a urologist near them, right? I mean, start to educate about, "Hey, hashtag stop bladder abuse,"
Yeah, I mean,
or
I was in Buenos Aires and, on vacation, and I went to a mall, and in the mall, every stall had basically how often are you getting up at night? Each stall had different questions, and at the bottom it said if you answered this, you need to go see a urologist. It was pretty. I have pictures. I took pictures of when I was there because it was so
that's awesome.
impactful. But it's and it was unbranded. It didn't say you got to go to this doctor. It was a public service announcement. And I think we could use some of that.
Well, I think we'll have to start the urinal vinyl mint thing. And I think maybe it should be like a target game, right? So you're hunting. And if you
Yes.
can't, like, and if, like, there's a lion at the very top, and if you can't hit the lion, you need to go see a urologist.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. There's so many. It's amazing what we call AI. Everything gets called AI now, but it's just algorithms. If there are so many different algorithms that we can implement now, that could really help people, and we need to start using that data,
Well, yeah, I'd love to see that imagery of these bathrooms with public service announcements about overactive bladder and BPH. And to wrap up, I just thank you so much. I think the real big takeaway for all the listeners, hey, hashtag stop bladder abuse. And really,
Yes.
let's work together to help our patients take off that armor of whatever defensive armor they may wear and have a conversation about their bladder health because you've only got one. You can't
It's true.
transplant.
It's true. It's one of the things that I find, I think is, when we look at, we call BPH a subset of conditions. BPH is just an anatomic, condition. What we really are trying to affect is bladder obstruction. We're trying to protect bladder abuse. So if we think about that, I think if we get nothing else from this discussion, let's all stop bladder abuse.
I love it. On that note, Dr. Mazlos, thank you for your time, your wisdom. I would love to connect and maybe even get some of those pictures because that's awesome. Thank you so much.
Sounds good. Deal. Bye.